Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
Any impact on shipping out of Seattle-Tacoma area is going to have an impact on Alaska.
The Seattle cargo shipping shutdown could bring delays to goods headed for Alaska. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, June 12th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Cooper Landing considers taxes to help pay for emergency services.
We're not here asking for the world. We're simply here asking for a minimal amount to keep our lights on.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you find yourself asking, what's next? The University of Alaska Anchorage can point you in the right direction. With over 100 fully accredited degree programs and certificates to choose from, plus resources to guide you through your academic experience, your future is in your hands. Whether you're starting over or taking your career to the next level, discover what's next at UAA. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
The Port of Seattle shut down its cargo operations Saturday due to labor conflicts, and the Port of Alaska says it could affect the state. About 90% of Alaska's goods arrive by ship or barge, and most of that comes via Seattle. Jim Jager is a spokesperson for the Port of Alaska in Anchorage.
Any impact on shipping out of Seattle-Tacoma area is going to have an impact on Alaska just because we're getting all of our goods there, or the vast majority.
Jager says half of the goods barged to Alaska stay in Anchorage and the other half is distributed throughout the state, even sent back down to communities in Southeast. The details of the shutdown are unclear. The Pacific Maritime Association, which represents terminal operators, blames the International Longshore and Warehouse Union. The labor union denies its worker strike is causing the port's closure. Jager says the extent of the impact on Alaska won't be known for a while, but he says it will likely be more of an inconvenience, like minor delays of goods getting onto shelves. He says the bulk of the slowdown is in international cargo, so it probably won't be a huge hit to Alaska.
I don't think it'll get terrible, but, you know, it all depends on your line of work. If you're worried about getting food for the grocery store, yeah, we'll get most of your stuff. On the other hand, if you're in a business that relies on something that's coming from Asia, you may have a real problem coming up.
Jager stresses that it's important for Alaskans to not panic shop as some did buying products like toilet paper during the pandemic. That could only make things worse.
It took 6 months to sort of get out of that whipsaw action of the supply chain. Could that happen? You bet it could. And will it happen? Oh, but with some goods it does.
As for the strike itself, Jager says there are different unions in Alaska and it won't affect port workers here. For people on the Yukon and Kuskokwim rivers, this is shaping up to be the fourth year in a row that subsistence salmon fishing is shut down or severely restricted. This has become an annual catastrophe that's felt acutely in the region. Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin is here to bring us up to speed on the YK salmon crisis and this year's projections. Liz, which salmon are affected?
Well, Chinook and Chum are the major salmon species on the Yukon and Kuskokwim, and those are the ones subsistence users rely on the most. They have been at historically low numbers in both rivers for years. And just to be clear, when we talk about subsistence, we mean harvesting for food rather than money and sport. Unfortunately, in recent years, coho, that's silvers, they have also dropped in number. So the fish that people used to rely on to, you know, at least partially make up for the loss of the other salmon, those have also diminished.
So talking about Chinook or king salmon, those runs should be starting around now, right? Is there really no subsistence fishing on the rivers?
Casey, for the past 3 years, the Yukon hasn't even seen sufficient numbers of salmon to meet the top priority, which is escapement. That's allowing enough fish to escape up the river to spawn. So there's no fishing for Chinook on the Yukon at all. Our colleague at KYUK, Francisco Martinez Cuello, went to Hooper Bay and heard a lot of folks at that meeting who were frustrated that they couldn't catch the fish they need to feed their families and to freeze for winter.
So that's the Yukon. And on the Kuskokwim, though, I've heard the picture is a little better.
Yeah, a little. The Kuskokwim has at least met Chinook escapement goals in recent years. They are also mostly shut down for Chinook now, but they are allowed a few 16-hour openings with smaller mesh set nets. I talked to Kevin Whitworth. He's the director of the Kuskokwim River Intertribal Fish Commission. Whitworth says the point of these brief openers is to let people on the Kuskokwim catch a few non-salmon fish, like whitefish and sheafish, and just to get a taste also of Chinook.
People are excited, for sure. It's the first part of the year where the fish start to come in and people want a fresh taste of fish. But there's a lot of people who remember the old days and where they're not able to catch the amounts necessary for subsistence.
Casey, I can imagine how hard it is to try to be happy with just a smattering of these beautiful kings when they used to be able to catch as many as they could handle. Last year, for the eighth year in a row, the Kuskokwim subsistence harvest of Chinook was far less than half of what the state considers adequate to meet the need.
Yeah, and like we said before, this has kind of become an annual thing, either, you know, severe restrictions or complete shutdowns. But what's the outlook like for the rest of this summer?
Again, Yukon Chinook are projected to come back in numbers too low to meet the escapement target. And it's unlikely that fishing will be allowed for subsistence. The Yukon chum runs are also expected to be poor, although managers may allow some subsistence fishing for summer chum. Fish managers on the Kuskokwim are expected to meet the escapement goal for Chinook, allowing for a very limited subsistence harvest. It's not clear yet whether chum and coho will meet the escapement targets.
I know it could be pretty complicated, but what do we know about why this is happening?
There's a lot of controversy. Clearly, multiple factors are at play. Warmer water in the Bering Sea and in the river, reduced prey supply. There's a parasite that plagues especially Yukon Chinook. And then there's bycatch. That's the accidental catch of salmon by the Bering Sea pollock fleet. And also the interception of fish on the Alaska Peninsula fishery that's known as Area M.
That bycatch and fish interception, that sounds like the controversial part.
Yes. The Bering Sea commercial fleet has caught about 13,000 Chinook so far this year. It infuriates Yukon and Kuskokwim subsistence fishermen who have sacrificed the fish they need to feed their families to allow for escapement. Pollock fishermen and Area M fishermen, they point to data showing only a teeny number of those fish would have returned to Western Alaska rivers. They say they're trying to limit bycatch, but they say the science doesn't back up the accusation that they're the cause of the salmon crisis.
Still, though, I imagine that argument is not persuasive in the YK Delta.
No, it is not. The subsistence fishermen acknowledge that climate change and environmental factors are likely huge reasons for the salmon crisis. But they say controlling bycatch is one of the few management tools available. And they say even if it's just a few hundred or a few thousand salmon that would have returned to the YK Delta, it's a situation where every spawner matters.
Okay, well, I guess we'll have to stay tuned to see what does pan out this summer. That was Alaska Public Media reporter Liz Ruskin. Liz, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Casey.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Bishop of the Russian Orthodox Church of Alaska visits some of the most remote congregants in the Aleutian Islands.
COVID has kept me out, and now that COVID is beginning to recede, I'm there to be with the people.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Annie Wright Schools, located in Tacoma, Washington, offers rich,
thoughtful and internationally recognized programs for students from around the world. A variety of boarding options are available year-round. There's a virtual preview of the school, the faculty, and campus for high school students seeking to explore international baccalaureate academics, arts, and athletics at aw.org/Alaska. This message sponsored by Annie Wright Schools.
Cooper Landing is taking its first steps toward creating a formal emergency service area, which would be funded by local taxes. After decades of operating as a volunteer-run nonprofit on a shoestring budget, local emergency responders are excited. But some borough officials are not so sure a service area is the best option. KDLL's Riley Board has the story.
Cooper Landing Emergency Services runs off donations and volunteers. But Clay Adam, a paramedic and the EMS chief at Cooper Landing Emergency Services, or CLES, says even though the community has been supportive, a donation-based budget just isn't sustainable in the long term.
And as we continue to move forward, and as a department, when we look at the long-term viability, we have to look at revenue streams and determine what is it going to take for this department to maintain the level of service that we provide currently.
Adam says the CLES budget doubled in the last 3 years, and that's just for essentials: fuel, heating, maintenance, and supplies. Adam says grants, which help cover costs, require more and more effort and pay out less funding than ever. And donations just won't sustain the needs of the department into the future. That's why CLES started talking about becoming a service area, a formalized fire and emergency service region paid for by tax revenue levied by the borough. Adam says that tax burden has been top of mind.
We looked at and researched a number of different avenues before we venture down the road of becoming a service area because we realize it's an additional burden on our community.
The process of creating a service area can start by petition or by a resolution in the Kenai Peninsula Borough Assembly, which member Cindy Eklund introduced at the Assembly's meeting Tuesday. Eklund's proposal met some resistance from Nikiski Assembly member Peter Ribbons and Mayor Peter Michicki. They suggested alternatives to the service area model because of the frequent tourist traffic through the Cooper Landing area.
I personally don't feel like the people of the Kenai should be solely responsible for 20,000 vehicle weekends that traverse the Sterling Highway. We're responsible for that, for paying for that response.
But CLES staff turned out in strong support of the resolution. Most assembly members agreed this would only be the first step that will allow Cooper Landing residents to settle the question for themselves. The resolution passed with only one no vote from Ribbons. Adam says he knows this is just the beginning. In the coming months, he's hoping to make his case to voters that it would be worthwhile to create the service area.
We're not here asking for the world. We're simply here asking for a minimal amount to keep our lights on and to continue to maintain the level of service that we provide currently to our community.
In order for the idea to move forward, it has to get on a mayor's report, make it to a public meeting held within the service area, and then get passed as an ordinance. If the proposal makes it through those next steps, it will go on the ballot for Cooper Landing voters in October. On the Kenai Peninsula, I'm Riley Board.
As the fishing season on the Kuskokwim River kicks off, many communities are still reeling from the effects of spring breakup flooding. This is especially true in the Upper River community of Crooked Creek, where in mid-May, residents found themselves on the wrong side of a 15-mile-long ice jam that inundated homes, led to a significant loss of stored food, and washed away critical fishing gear. As KYUK's Evan Erickson reports, Crooked Creek villagers still have a long way to go to get back on their feet.
Located about 200 miles up the Kuskokwim River from Bethel, Crooked Creek is no stranger to severe breakup flooding. In 2011, the village of fewer than 100 people saw what was characterized as a 100-year flood, so severe that it only had a 1% chance of occurring in any given year. This year's flooding was even worse, according to Alaska Pacific River Forecast Center meteorologist Mike Ottenweller.
We estimate that the flood exceeded the 2011 floods by approximately 4 to 5 feet.
Residents only had about 18 hours to brace for the deluge.
That rise of 16 feet actually happened pretty much from Saturday afternoon into Sunday morning because of the conditions with the ice and also the colder than normal temperatures and the higher than normal snowpack through the spring. All those things came together to create this pretty significant, potentially historic event.
Amid a state natural disaster declaration, an alphabet soup of organizations came to the aid of the community, including the Red Cross, the Alaska Organized Militia, the Salvation Army, Samaritan's Purse, the Association of Village Council Presidents, and Donlin Gold. While on-site responders have largely departed, the state will continue to coordinate efforts to rebuild Crooked Creek throughout the summer. Severe damage and power outages have cost the village a large percentage of its stored subsistence foods.
We've been providing a lot of shelf-stable foods to people, but those aren't the traditional foods that people in that area prefer.
That's Jeremy Zedek, a spokesperson with the State Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management.
It's a hardship that they can't eat these foods that they gather themselves from their area.
Crooked Creek Tribal President Julia Zakar has been working around the clock to address the community's needs.
The gentleman who didn't lose any boats before the beaver season ended, they went out and did beaver hunting so they could we could supply the food for the shelter. And the families who were on higher ground donated moose meat and fish, but that is all running low now. And so we're trying to make good with what we have. We're doing okay, but it's just very, very stressful.
Zakar said that the flood had washed away much of the community's fishing gear, including boats, dip nets, and three fish wheels. She called into a recent Kuskokwim River salmon management meeting to plead with state fisheries managers to immediately open the river to drift net fishing to replenish community food stores. This came during a five-day period known as a front-end closure intended to protect king and chum salmon stocks. But Zakar said that she couldn't see the justification.
For us to be closed right now, it's very hard because we need the fish more now to help feed the community. And, you know, the she fish, the white fish are there. There's no salmon this far up. And we would be able to use that fish for the main course of the meal instead of having to try and gather food from like Anchorage or different organizations that are helping us.
Zakar praised the help coming from around the state to Crooked Creek, but said she was hopeful that a federal disaster declaration would come and bring additional support.
Families are living in the school gym. Thank goodness for Cusbuck School District for allowing us to use it as a shelter and feeding station. And we do have three tents set up right now. We're waiting for AVCP to send more tents for more AVCP homeowners because families are living with families and, you know, that's pretty rough right now. Thank goodness we did not lose anybody to the flood.
As Crooked Creek rebuilds, severely affected communities over on the Yukon River are doing the same. According to Zedek, there has been no shortage of challenges offered up by Mother Nature.
We've had a very busy couple years. 2022, we had 14 state-declared disasters and 6 federal. If we look back to 1978, we averaged about 5 disasters per year, so 14 is really a big bump for us.
In Bethel, I'm Evan Erickson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from oversized equipment to small packages for commercial or residential. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. If you find yourself asking, what's next? The University of Alaska Anchorage can point you in the right direction. With over 100 fully accredited degree programs and certificates to choose from, plus resources to guide you through your academic experience, your future is in your hands. Whether you're starting over or taking your career to the next level, discover what's next at UAA. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
A 23-year-old man drowned Saturday night after a canoe capsized on a lake in the Matanuska Susitna Borough. Alaska State Troopers say they were told at about 7 p.m. Saturday that Devin Betker was presumed dead on Finger Lake between Palmer and Wasilla. Troopers, medics, and the borough dive team responded. Troopers say Betker and two other men had been paddling to an island when their canoe capsized in about 20 feet of water. The other men grabbed the canoe and held on until a rescue boat arrived, but Betker went under and they lost sight of him. Troopers say Betker's body was recovered about 90 minutes later. A recent state report says Alaska has the nation's highest rate of drownings. Risk factors include sporadic use of life jackets, cold water that can kill even strong swimmers, and remoteness that can hamper rescue efforts. Gas seeps near the Aleutian Islands deep sea were discovered last month. It was during a U.S. federal expedition. KUCB's Sophia Stewart Rossi takes us on board the research vessel to learn more about what the discovery means.
And so we're going to go up two flights of stairs. I'll take you to the bridge.
Okay. The Okeanos Explorer is docked in Unalaska, and it just finished its first of six expeditions mapping out the deep sea floor around the Aleutian Islands. It's May, and the weather is starting to calm down from the winter season, making it safer for research boats to come out to the Bering Sea. I'm with Expedition Coordinator Sam Cuellar on board. He's with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and works on the 224-foot research vessel.
So this is our control room. This is where we run all the mapping from, is this back row here.
On this ship, Cuellar and his crew discovered three seeps bubbling gas through the seafloor in the Aleutian Trench. And according to NOAA, the discovery is crucial. It's because these gas seeps can create unique surrounding habitats and could provide potential sources of alternative energy and biopharmaceuticals. But to Cuellar and his crew, it was just another day on the job.
If you're in that kind of routine, it's not exciting because it's not important. It's just, it's part of your job, and it's really cool to note, but you just keep going on with your job and keep looking for more.
Cuellar says finding these gas seeps wasn't a total surprise. That's because there's research from the U.S. Geological Survey that predicts where gas seeps could be in Alaska's waters. And now with more advanced machinery, there can be more advanced data collection from the seafloor.
Now that you're seeing the different technologies catch up with being able to more properly and economically extract resources from the deep sea floor, we need to better understand them for protection, but also to understand what kind of resources are here.
Alaska's oceans are predominantly unexplored. Cuellar says it's partially due to Alaska's remoteness from the rest of the United States and the environmental difficulties that come with being so far north. But he said ice sheet melt from global warming is making seas more accessible than ever before.
And so there's a renewed push by the U.S. government to better understand what is in those types of waters now that they're accessible.
The Okeanos Explorer is out at sea till mid-October, mapping the deep waters around the Aleutian Islands, in the Aleutian Trench, and in the Gulf of Alaska. You can track the ship online at NOAA's website, and the collected data will be accessible to the public during and after expeditions. In Unalaska, I'm Sophia Stewart Rossi.
It's been nearly 3 years since the Archbishop of the Orthodox Church of Alaska passed away. The church elected a new bishop last year, a major move for the Alaska Diocese, which is arguably the largest in the entire Orthodox Church. KUCB's Theo Greenlee reports that in May, Alaska's new leader, Bishop Alexei, made his first visit to the Aleutian and Pribilof Islands, some of the farthest-flung parishes in the diocese.
There are around 50 people who live in Atka, and about half of them are at the airstrip to meet the plane that just landed. But on this gray, windy morning in late May, they're here for more than the usual shipment of mail and occasionally donuts from Dutch Harbor. A tall man with a long gray beard, flowing black robes, emerges from the plane, and the people greet him with a hymn. Bishop Alexei took over as the head of the Alaska Diocese last year, after the previous Bishop David Mahaffey passed away in 2020. He says he's been trying to visit the 80 or so parishes in his vast region.
I'm in the Aleutians, making a pastoral visit to reach out to the people, to let the people know that the church, which has been with them, supporting them, supporting their culture from the very beginning, that it is still here. COVID has kept me out, and now that COVID is beginning to recede, I'm there to be with the people.
The Orthodox Church holds a complicated position in Unanga culture and history. While many Russian settlers committed atrocities in the Aleutian Islands, The Orthodox Church was widely embraced, in part because it integrated Unanga traditions and culture into the church.
The Russian church always took what they saw in the community, saw in the people, and they said, this is beautiful. This is worth preserving.
The bishop's also here to perform the hierarchical divine liturgy, which is only served in his grace's presence. But there's been a bit of a hiccup.
We heard, you know, the flights the day before had canceled.
Crystal Dushkin grew up in Attica, and she helped organize the bishop's visit. She says the bishop's flight was almost canceled. It was touch and go, but the bishop and the clergy did make it in. But the bishop's bags, they got bumped.
Oh yeah, the vestments didn't make it in.
The bishop wears special liturgical robes, and he can't perform certain services without them, including the hierarchical divine liturgy. I asked Dushkin about it. She isn't fazed.
I gotta tell you, I was nervous.
I was kind of oddly calm. It actually worked out beautifully because the bishop, with not having his vestments, he wasn't able to serve. And so he sang with us in the choir.
St. Nicholas Church is one of the oldest parishes in the state, and it hasn't had a resident priest since 1899. Still, the congregation has maintained the songs and liturgies for over a century. They're performed in several languages, including English, Church Slavonic, and Unangam Tenu.
There is a great love for the tradition, a great love for the languages that that they've maintained. They have maintained miraculously.
So they held evening services, and the bishop sang in the choir. But the next morning, the clouds parted, the heavens shone down, and a Beechcraft King Air twin turboprop plane landed in Attica, this time with the vestments, and just in time for church.
Well, by the grace of God, by the prayers of St. Nicholas, by the prayers of St. Jacob, we were able to celebrate the divine hierarchical divine liturgy. Getting the vestments here was, of course, no easy task. But it was no easy task to get the relics of St. Nikolai from...
Most of the folks in Attica are congregants, and the church still holds a special place in the community. Church attendance in Alaska has declined in recent years, following similar trends of varying faiths across the nation. Still, more than 200 years after the Russian Orthodox Church was established in Alaska, the church cites roughly 50,000 to 60,000 adherents statewide. In Attica, I'm Theo Greenlee.
That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Angela Denning in Petersburg, Chris Clint and Liz Ruskin in Anchorage, Riley Board in Kenai, Sophia Stewart-Rossi in Unalaska, and Theo Greenlee way out there in Attica. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
And by
Princess Lodges, offering glass-domed railcar tours to Talkeetna and Denali National Park for Alaska summer adventures. Your journey begins at princesslodges.com.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.